He'd collected the samples Dr. Nakis needed.
They're in your lunchbox, he added. I put another cold pack in there as well to keep them fresh.
My lunchbox? I shuddered. Ew. Alan looked at me askance.
You're kidding, right? You keep human brains in that thing.
Yes, brains, not fecal samples. I shuddered again. He rolled his eyes.
The container is sealed. I promise you won't get any BM on your brains.
I gave him a challenging stare. Is that the best alliteration you can come up with? Bowel movements and plain old brains? Alan chuckled.
I'd like to see you do better with the material at hand.
Let's see. There's poop on your pons, or crack on your corpus callosum, or doo-doo on your dura, or...
Stop.
He lifted his hands in surrender.
You win.
Damn straight, I said, preening. And I'm going to leave now, so you can cry about how sad your wordplay game is.
Sad indeed, he said. I think I liked it better when you hated me.
Well, how's this for old time's sake, then? I said, grinning as I flipped him off.
You've never flipped me off before.
Not to your face. He groaned.
Go. Depart. I'll see you tomorrow.
I was smiling as I snagged my lunchbox, but my mood had dimmed considerably by the time I reached my car. It was fun bantering with Alan about the grossness of the samples, but they were a reminder of the gigantic problem known as Douglas Shamblin' Man Horton. The tribe's zombie research lab was over 20 minutes away, giving me far too much time to fret about zombie gators on the loose in Mudsucker Swamp. Then again, Dr. Nakis already had several bits of Mr. Horton's brain. It was possible he'd already examined them and instantly realized why the man had gone all walking dead on us. And perhaps he'd even come up with a way to make sure it never happened again. Totally possible. I grimly clung to that optimism for the rest of the drive. Eventually, I arrived at the tribe zombie research lab, an utterly nondescript, faded blue, windowless cinder block building, squatting in a desolate field surrounded by a thick pine forest in the middle of nowhere, Louisiana. I parked in the gravel lot and sauntered up to the single door that marked the front. There were other exterior doors, but they were carefully concealed and massively secured. So much so that the one time the lab had been infiltrated, the Saberton aggressors had no choice but to make entry via the front door, and that was no walk in the park, unless you were welcome. Though everyone referred to this building as the lab, it was much more than a research facility. A medical area served both zombies and humans, permanent quarters housed the handful of personnel who lived at the lab, and nicely furnished dorm-like rooms accommodated temporary guests. There were even cells for unwilling guests, plus an emergency bunker that could supposedly survive damn near anything but a direct nuclear strike. Moreover, Dr. Nakis was a key member of the tribe and part of the inner circle, and since he rarely left the building, the lab also served as the de facto headquarters for tribe operations. After clearing all three security doors, I passed through the central hub and into the research wing of the building. In the chemical assay room, a pale, thin, ponytailed man sat hunched on a stool as he calibrated a spectrophotometer. Jacques Leroux, Dr. Nakis's right-hand man. Though I was fairly sure he didn't have any medical or science degrees, he knew Dr. Nakis's methods and moods inside and out and was a skilled medic and research assistant. Of course, he probably didn't need any degrees considering he'd worked side by side with Dr. Nakis since the Franco-Prussian War. Jacques glanced up, expressive hazel eyes startling, as always, given his otherwise wan appearance. Those eyes flicked to the box in my hand.
You have the rest of the samples?
Yep, everything Dr. Nakis asked for.
That's good news, he said,
returning his attention to the calibration.
Dr. Nikas is still working on the brain pieces Rachel delivered. If you could prepare slides for what you brought, it would be very helpful.
Got it covered. I tamped down on my disappointment that Dr. Nikas hadn't already solved the Shambler mystery, then tugged on gloves and worked on getting slides set up. Dr. Nikas knew everything there was to know about the zombie parasite and how zombies worked. If there was an answer to be had, he'd find it. Or would he? I despised the whisper of uncertainty that crept in. Only a couple of weeks ago, Dr. Nikas himself confessed his self-doubt and told me that despite his centuries of experience, there was still only so much one man could do to tackle the mass of needed research. For several months last year, Dr. Christy Charish had been an unwilling guest of the tribe. Though she was an evil psychopath, she was also an utterly brilliant neurobiologist. During the short time Dr. Nikas worked with her, he'd made more progress in all of his research and development than in the past decade. Two incredible minds working together had produced far greater results than either could have managed on their own, even with all the time in the world. The sad truth was that Dr. Nikas and Christy were perfect research partners, each able to expand and extrapolate upon the other's ideas. But Christy had only helped because she had no choice. Though she'd surely filed away juicy research results in her twisted brain the entire time, considering she now worked for Saberton Corporation, it was unlikely she and Dr. Nikas would ever be brainstorm buddies again. I fucking hated Christy Charish with the fiery heat of a thousand suns, but not having her brain power flat out sucked for our current situation. I finished the slides and put the rest of the samples in the fridge. Is there anything else that needs doing?
Not at the moment, thanks to your recent industry, Jacques said, eyes crinkling with a rare display of humor.
My recent industry had been an effort to keep from dying of boredom during my recovery. I'd quickly grown sick of browsing the internet and watching TV, so once I had the strength, I wheeled my little butt over to the lab and took on all the low-priority tasks that tended to pile up. I skimmed a glance around the room. Maybe I should see if Reg needs anything? Or inventory the reagents?
Angel, you have inventoried, cleaned, organized, and labeled everything in this lab that can be seen without a microscope.
He paused.
And a few things that can't.
Damn. A faint smile tugged at his mouth.
Don't worry. You haven't inventoried yourself out of a job. We are simply in a holding pattern while Dr. Nikas works. You know how he can be.
I snorted. Utterly absorbed didn't even begin to describe Dr. Nikas when he was working through a problem. He would ignore everyone and everything, muttering to himself in languages no one spoke anymore, filling whiteboards with formulas and symbols and whatnot, and forgetting to eat or drink until Jacques gently pushed one or the other into his free hand. And even then, surfacing from his deep focus, only enough to chew and swallow.
I'll go check the heads and Kang, I said. I'll call you when I need you.
Not if he needed me. When. That felt nice. I'd never be as kick-ass brilliant as Dr. Nikas or even Jacques, but I could be the best damn assistant ever. Chapter 5. Kang was John Kang, the first zombie who'd admitted to me he was a zombie. He had worked at Scott Funeral Home, and not long after I started working at the morgue, he confronted me about brains missing from body bags, brains I'd harvested from autopsied bodies for my own consumption. Turned out he'd been running a side business providing brains for zombies who didn't have any reliable sources. Lucky for me, once Kang was satisfied I wasn't going to cut into his business, he helped me adjust to becoming a zombie. After all, he'd been one for 70-something years. And though we never really became friends, we'd been fairly friendly associates who had a common goal. Survival. I had warned Kang a serial killer was hell-bent on collecting zombie heads,
but he didn't bother to take precautions and ended up getting his own head chopped off. Several months later, I discovered Christy Charish had orchestrated the zombie murders because she wanted the heads for her own depraved research. After a shitstorm of shenanigans and downright unpleasantness, the tribe recovered 7 heads, including Kang's, from her private lab. Dr. Nikas then began the uncertain and monumental task of regrowing zombies from their heads alone. And the regrowth lab, aka the headroom, was my current destination. I passed through the lab's central rotunda, down a corridor with walls decorated in colorful tile mosaics. Near the end, I punched my code into the number pad on an unmarked door. The lock clicked, and I stepped into the room. Cold air sent goosebumps racing over my skin as I paused to let my eyes adjust to the dim lighting that was ideal for regrowth. An empty, coffin-sized glass tank dominated one side of the room, and a counter along the far wall held 4 stainless steel, crockpot-looking vats. Each contained a zombie head and 15 gallons of nutrient medium, an amount I knew all too well since one of my weekly duties was to change the snot-like goop. Taped to the front of each vat was an index card bearing the name of the occupant. I peered through the glass cover of the vat marked Adam Campbell. Sightless, white-filmed eyes stared up from the gray, shriveled flesh of his face. Exactly the same as when I'd checked on him yesterday. Absolutely 0 sign of regrowth. The parasite activity indicators on the side of the vat were also the same as yesterday. The parasite was dormant, but still viable. In stasis, according to Dr. Nikas. A quick check of the other 3 vats revealed the same. Dormant, but viable. 2 of the recovered heads hadn't fared as well. Peter Plesha's parasite bit the dust a couple of days after arriving at the lab, and Timothy Kay's died while Dr. Nikas was in New York. I dutifully entered the parasite activity onto the tablet on the counter, then left and locked the room. Kang had been the only one to show any sign of progress. He had spent the last few months regrowing his body in the coffin tank, and 4 days ago, he'd finally been transferred to a hospital bed in the lab's medical wing, which was where I headed next. Though it wasn't so much a wing as a hallway, with a half dozen hospital-type rooms. 2 of the rooms were for prisoners or hostels, equipped with constant surveillance and steel doors that required a code for both entry and exit. To my annoyance, Kang was in one of the secured rooms. The reasoning was that, since he was coming back from a frozen head, no one knew what he'd be like when he woke up. He might be brain dead, or normal Kang, or possibly even violent psycho Kang. Better to have him locked down, just to be safe. But I'd seen him in the tank during the first attempt to resurrect him a couple of weeks ago. I'd met his eyes. I knew he was totally Kang and not some brain-warped crazy thing. Unfortunately, no one was willing to take my gut feeling as proof of his Kangness. His door was half open, and a woman's voice drifted into the hall. Poor prey to his hot fit of pride were those. And now upon his western wing he leaned. Now his huge bulk o'er Afric sands careened. Now the black planet shadowed Arctic snows, soaring through wider zones that pricked his scars. Within, a dark-haired woman with a slim athletic build sat beside the bed, reading aloud from a book with a tattered green cover. Naomi Comptis, one of the few non-zombies who worked for the tribe. She was actually Julia Saber, twin sister to Andrew Saber, and daughter of Saberton's unscrupulous CEO, Nicole Saber. Julia had worked in corporate espionage until she discovered the atrocities committed against zombies by her own company.
Since she knew her mother wouldn't hesitate to have her killed in order to protect Saberton, Julia had fled.
After a rocky start, the tribe took her in and helped her change her identity to Naomi. Though, unfortunately, a surveillance device had blown her cover a few months back. Kang lay motionless in the bed, wrapped in gauze from neck to ankles like a zombie mummy,
On the wall, an origami dragon perched atop a monitor, where squiggly lines crawled across the screen, tracking vital signs, brain activity, and heart rhythm. Kang was definitely alive, and all of his various parts seemed to be in order, except, apparently, his eyelids, because he sure as hell hadn't opened them since he came out of the tank. Naomi had read or talked to him every day he'd been in this room. A half dozen other origami animals lurked, crouched, or perched on the nightstand. Swan, bear, horse, elephant, bird, and frog. Naomi did origami when she was stressed or bored, and she stayed far too busy to be bored. She flicked a glance my way, lifted a hang-on-a-sec finger, and kept on reading. With memory of the old revolt from awe, he reached a middle height, and at the stars which are the brain of heaven he looked and sank. Around the ancient track marched rank on rank the army of unalterable law. She let out a sigh of satisfaction and gave me a smile. Look at you, standing upright and all. The last time she'd seen me, I was clinging to a walker for dear life as I staggered down the hallway. Haven't fallen on my ass yet today, knock wood. I rapped my knuckles on the doorframe, producing a dull metal thud. What on earth are you reading to him? Lucifer and Starlight. It's one of his favorites. She turned her gaze to the silent figure in the bed. I think I saw an eyelid twitch, but that might have been wishful thinking. Wishful and maybe a teensy bit impatient, I moved to the bed and peered at Kang's face. Her brows drew together in a frown. I'm not impatient. I'm worried. You woke up the day after you came out of the tank. I wasn't regrown from just a head. Plus, Dr. Nikus had the new and improved regrowth formula, thanks to Alan's information. I got dunked in the good stuff from the very beginning. Not to mention, I was nice and fresh when I went into the tank. Kang and the others had been sitting in a freezer for a couple of months. And, by the time I fell apart, Dr. Nikus had over a year of experience from working with the heads. Naomi made a face. All right, that makes sense. Damn it. I couldn't blame her for worrying. She and Kang had been friends long before I ever met him. In fact, their friendship had been the seed for her divorce from Saberton. Because of Kang, Naomi had understood that zombies were people, not monsters. He's going to be fine, I said with all the reassurance I could muster. At least Dr. Nikus laid down the law to stop Pierce from trying to make Kang wake up. Her nose wrinkled. Pierce was in here earlier, checking if there'd been any change. The original Pierce Gentry had been a Saberton security badass, until tribe leader Pietro Ivanov killed him to escape Saberton's prison lab in New York. But he hadn't just killed him. Pietro had eaten Pierce's brain and used a mature zombie ability to mimic his DNA, and thus physically became Pierce.
For the sake of security, as well as to keep Saberton from learning about mature zombies and their abilities,
it was decided Pietro Ivanov would die in a plane crash, and everyone would be told that Pierce Gentry had been a tribe operative the whole time and would rejoin the tribe now. Only a handful of people knew the truth. The Pierce Gentry who'd returned with us from New York was in fact Pietro Ivanov. Did Pierce do anything? Nothing, other than sniff Kang and scowl a lot. I snickered. Yeah, because Dr. Nikus would have his head otherwise. Ever since Kang started regrowing, Pierce had pressured Dr. Nikus to hurry the process and pestered him with questions. How quickly will Kang recover? And will he have all of his memories? And others along the same line. It was obvious Pierce desperately wanted to know something only Kang could tell him, but Dr. Nikus had put his foot down. He didn't care what Pierce wanted from Kang. His first priority was to his patient. Period. Finally,
During a particularly heated exchange, Dr. Nikas pointed out that if Pierce insisted on rushing the regrowth and recovery,
Kang might not be in a condition to answer any questions, ever. That stark truth backed Pierce off.
Naomi blew out her breath. Yeah, Dr. N is the best. I should have more faith in him. She summoned a smile. Have you heard from Andrew? For a fraction of an instant, I considered telling her about the game console, but immediately discarded that idea. I didn't know if it was from Andrew, and Naomi could get pretty emotional when it came to her brother. It would be way worse for her if I told her about the package, and then it turned out it really was from some long-lost cousin named Arnold Stein. I shook my head. He was on CNN last night, talking about some trade agreement and its impact on something or other. My eyes glazed over after about 30 seconds, but he sure looked alive to me. I saw that one too. Alive and in India. A slight crease formed between her eyebrows. You don't believe he's really there? Her eyes snapped to mine. Do you? Not for a second, I said. I think he's been doing interviews and stuff like this to make it look like he's there. Exactly, Naomi cried, relief washing over her face. And he's probably video conferencing for board meetings and other matters. Heck, over half the board attends remotely, and if Andrew has a tech person on tap, he could appear to be connecting from anywhere he wants. He has Thea Braddock, I said, referring to his bodyguard and the former head of security for Saberton, New York. She's super competent, and I bet she found someone to do that for him. But he's so new to being a zombie. What if he's not getting enough brains? He didn't look at all brain hungry on CNN, I reassured her. Plus, I trust Thea to get whatever he needs. The tension in her shoulders eased. Right. Of course. So he's okay. That's right. I mentally crossed fingers it was true, then decided to shift the conversation to a less worry-filled topic. So, are you going to stay Naomi or go back to Julia? I mean, your cover is totally blown and everyone, including your mother, knows you're really Julia Saber. Her expression turned fierce. I don't want to be a Saber. I'm a completely different person now, both inside and out. You never seemed like a Julia to me. Exactly. I've never felt like a Julia. I feel like an angel, but I sure as hell don't act like one. You do in all the ways that matter, Naomi said with unexpected warmth, then glanced at her phone when it buzzed. Judy calls. Let me know if Kang does anything interesting. She closed her book and set it on the nightstand, then stood and leaned close to his face. Hey. Wake the fuck up, you lazy shirker. Kang remained utterly still, except for the shallow rise and fall of his chest. Naomi straightened with a sigh. Worth a try. She flashed me a cheery smile that didn't fool me one bit. Catch you later, babe. She was out the door before I realized she hadn't asked about the Shambler incident at the morgue, which meant she didn't know about it. Was it being kept from her because she was human? Or was the info restricted to the tribe's inner circle? Or, in a less paranoid world, maybe she'd simply been busy and hadn't heard the latest gossip yet. I plopped into the chair and picked up the book. Victorian Poetry from Clough to Kipling. On a whim, I opened to a random page and started reading. Come fill the cup. And in the fire of spring, your winter garment of repentance fling. The bird of time has but a little way to flutter, and the bird is on the wing. What the shit? I made a face and set the book aside. She's trying to torture you awake, Kang. Why else would she read you this?
Kang likes to style himself an autodidactic polymath.
Pierce drawled from the doorway. The fit, broad-shouldered 30-something Pierce Gentry was a far cry from his old Pietro Ivanov form, but I was used to it now. Helped that his personality hadn't really changed. I had no idea what an
automatic polymorphy thing was, but I also didn't care about looking stupid in front of Pierce. A what's it, who's it?
An autodidact is a self-taught person, and a polymath is one whose expertise covers a wide variety of subjects.
He closed the door behind him.
I style Kang a pompous ass.
I tensed as Pierce approached the bed. He smirked.
Don't worry. I'll abide by Ari's wishes.
More like Dr. Nikus's commands, I thought, but kept my expression bland. He folded his arms over his chest.
Tell me everything of what happened at the morgue.
My eyes flicked toward Kang. Here? Couldn't some coma patients still hear what was going on around them? I definitely remembered bits and pieces from my time regrowing in the tank.
He's not awake, Angel,
Pierce said, misinterpreting my hesitation.
I would know if he was faking unconsciousness. Even Kang can't control himself to that extent. Now tell me what happened.
I didn't think he was awake, I muttered, then went ahead and launched into the stirring tale of Angel and the not-really-zombie. When I finished, I slouched in the chair and eyed him. What did you mean by even Kang? Pierce didn't answer for several seconds, still mulling over my story.
His great age affords him certain advantages.
Great age? But he's only 70-something, isn't he? I mean, he told me his parents died in the Korean War. That was old, but not old. Hell, Jacques was pushing 200. Pierce gave me a slow blink. Then he tipped his head back and roared in laughter.
My God, Kang is such an asshole. Yes, his parents died in a Korean War, but not the one in the 20th century.
My face felt ready to break from the confused expression. There was more than one?
That area has known many wars, Pierce said with way too much delight.
He leaned down and placed his hands on the arms of my chair.
As does any country with a long history. Gojoseon was Korea's first kingdom, founded in 2333 BC. By Dangun Wangji-um. Gojoseon lasted for many centuries until Emperor Wudi of the Han Dynasty invaded. It fell after a year of war and disintegrated into fiefdoms and confederacies, which later came together to form new kingdoms and wage new wars.
I assume you're telling me this for a reason, I snapped. Then fought the urge to shrink away as he brought his face close to mine.
Kang's parents died when Emperor Wudi's forces invaded, he intoned, in the year 109 B.C.
I gulped. Kang is over 2,000 years old? Holy fucking shit. Pierce straightened and cast a mocking glance at Kang's still form.
He's a bit older than 70, I'd say.
How old are you? I blurted. He slid a look to me.
I was born in the Emirate of Cordoba. I don't know my exact birth year, but my best estimate is somewhere around the year of our Lord, 760.
His mouth crooked.
I was an old man of perhaps 4 decades when Kang turned me.
He pivoted and strode to the door, leaving on a perfect dramatic note. Until I ruined it. Hang on, Pierce. Something doesn't make sense. Pierce stopped, then slowly turned back to me, a thin smile on his face and annoyance in his eyes.
Yes, Angel.
I stood and folded my arms over my chest in a mock Pierce pose. If Kang is so old, then he has the mature zombie super senses, right? His head dipped a couple of millimeters. Kang is indeed a mature zombie.
Then how did Ed Quinn get the jump on him to chop his head off? Kang would have smelled him coming and known he was up to no good. A rush of exultation flooded me.
That's what you want to know, isn't it? You want to ask him how Ed managed it so you can defend against it.
The amusement returned to Pierce's eyes.
Kang was tranked first, just enough to dull his senses.
My exultation popped like a soap bubble. Oh. His smile widened.
I'd wondered the same thing, so I asked Quinn.
Right. I fought back a scowl. Of course he would ask Ed. Want to know how someone was murdered? Ask the murderer.
He informed me that Kang was staggering down the corridor and didn't hear him come in.
Pierce looked positively elated as he stomped my theory into dust.
Quinn thought he was drunk. I knew that wasn't possible. And believed a trank was to blame. Dr. Nikas confirmed my hunch by finding traces of zombie tranquilizer compound in Kang's neck tissues.
You're enjoying this way too much, I said sourly. But that's cool. I'll let you have this one. Still, if Ed didn't trank him, who did?
Pierce's smile spread into a grin. My guess is Christy Charish. That woman is devilishly clever.
I snatched up the book of poetry. I swear to God, I will bean you right in the head if you don't stop gloating. Whistling, you can't always get what you want, he turned and strolled down the hall. I stuck my head out the door. You know, you could just tell me what the hell you need from Kang. Still whistling, he lifted his right hand to give me the finger, keeping it raised until he turned the corner. I chuckled, despite myself, then glanced at Kang. And he has the balls to call you an asshole. Then again, you made me believe you were only 70. Guess it takes one to know one. I returned to the bed and leaned close. You know, Kang, whatever it is he wants to know, just think how much it would piss him off if you told me first. No reaction. Not even the slightest blip on the monitor. Damn it. All right, be stubborn, but I'll be back. I watched him for a few more seconds, then left, locking the door behind me. Chapter 6. I returned to Jacques only to learn that Dr. Nikas had finished with the samples Rachel delivered, but was now absorbed in analyzing the stuff I'd brought. Fine, I said, not bothering to hide my frustration. I'll be in the media room. I'll let him know, Jacques replied, unruffled as always. Grumpy and frustrated, I retrieved my school backpack from my car, then made my way to the media room. Personally, I thought it should be called the living room since it looked and felt like one with comfy sofas, recliners, an armchair, and a gigantic flat-screen TV. Reg, Dr. Nikas's other lab tech, snoozed in a recliner that looked a size too small for his long and lean frame. A half-full glass of brain smoothie sat on the table beside him, and a sheath of lab printouts rested on his chest. His head was cocked toward one shoulder at a painful angle. I had a feeling he hadn't meant to fall asleep. Hey, Reg, I said softly. He startled awake, sending papers sailing.
Angel, damn.
I dropped my backpack on the sofa and hurried to gather the printouts. Sorry, I thought you'd want a nudge awake.
Yeah, thanks.
Reg shoved the recliner footrest closed and sat up.
I have plenty of work to do. My boss is a real hard ass, you know?
I rolled my eyes and shoved the gathered papers into his hands. Uh-huh. Right. Dr. Nikas is a certified meanie pants. Reg chuckled and ran his fingers through unruly red curls in a futile attempt to tame them. A few months back, he decided a buzz cut wasn't his thing anymore and opted for more of a shaggy poodle style. I'd never tell him in a million years, but
I preferred the curls, simply because he was so tall and skinny the buzz cut had made him look a bit too much like a matchstick. He downed the smoothie, stood, and stretched.
You know what we need around here? Cats.
Sure.
We have a dog in the lab now. Would be cool to have a couple of cats to make things homey.
I've never had a cat, I shrugged. Or any pet, for that matter.
Oh, man, Angel, you're missing out. Nothing like kicking back with a good book and a cat on your lap.
A whisper of nostalgia touched his voice, but then he winked.
And one chewing on your hair. And one knocking breakables onto the floor just to watch them fall.
I gave him a dubious look. Hair chewing and property destruction. Sounds great. I've really been missing out.
Animals are the best.
He then whinnied, quacked, and croaked, all very convincingly. When I stopped laughing, I said, why stop with a cat? Might as well bring in a bunny rabbit and a pony while we're at it. Maybe an iguana.
Why the hell not?
He said with a mischievous sparkle in his eye, then sauntered out, whistling Old MacDonald. What a goofball. Sharp and dedicated and nice as hell, but still a goofball.
Never change, Reg, I murmured, then settled on one of the sofas and pulled a composition notebook from my backpack.
The required reading for my English comp class was a pain in the butt, even with the mod Dr. Nikas gave me to help with my dyslexia. But the true bane of my existence and a quarter of my grade was the personal journal. We were supposed to write daily entries about the events of the day and how we felt about them. Our personal struggles, hopes, dreams, accomplishments, fears, worries, blah, blah, blah. Everyone in the class agreed it was a dumb waste of time, but I was fairly certain no one else was forced to make up most of their journal entries. The professor was nice and all, but I knew damn well if I turned in a journal entry of, Dear Diary, today I finally finished regrowing my body after my legs and arms fell off, I would earn a swift F. After a moment's consideration, I started an entry about changing an old lady's tire. Seriously heartwarming shit. And way more plausible than tending heads in crockpots or fighting the mindless dead.
Angel.
Dr. Nikas stood in the doorway, a German shepherd by his side, Marla, a cadaver dog who'd been used to track zombies. My heart dropped to my toes at Dr. Nikas's troubled expression.
I caused it, didn't I?
The shambling zombie. He sat in the chair next to me. Marla settled at his feet and rested her head atop his shoes.
You frame it as if you made a deliberate choice.
He lifted a hand to stop my protest.
I beg you not to give me some pap about how you chose to take the drugs that damaged your parasite. It happened. It's past. That line of thinking is of benefit to no one.
A smile brushed across his face as I closed my mouth.
Analysis of the tissue samples you collected showed Douglas Horton and Judd Seiler had remarkably similar, we'll say infections, for lack of a better word. With the pathogen being an aberration of the normal zombie parasite.
And considering Mr. Horton was found in the same swamp where Mr. Seiler met his end,
it is safe to hypothesize that the disease transferred from Judd Seiler's remains to Mr. Horton by some means, and that you are, indeed, the source of the mutation.
I bit Judd once. How could that? I straightened. Wait. When I was a prisoner in Christy Charish's lab, after I turned Philip, and after she screwed him up with bad fake brains, he bit those two guards. And they turned into screwed up zombies fast from just one bite. They weren't shamblers, but They were unstable, bitey. Dr. Nikus nodded.
His bite caused a rapid turning. Your bite on Judd Seiler took over a day to make him turn. But you and Philip Bolt had very damaged parasites at the time of those incidents. I have been seeking the mechanism for the aberration and accelerated effort of the mutation. Frustration and weariness shadowed his eyes. I continue to search for answers.
He didn't have to add, without the benefit of another researcher. I found my voice. Are Philip and me still dangerous that way?
No, he said, firm and reassuring. Your parasite has recovered to a significant degree, as has Philip's. Every test I've conducted on you two indicates nothing out of the ordinary for one of our kind.
Whew, I managed to smile. Okay, so Judd didn't bite Douglas Horton, but an alligator did. I took most of Judd's brain but left his body out in the swamp. Could a gator turn into a zombie from eating Judd? He spread his hands.
Occam's razor.
Wait, I know that. The easiest explanation is most likely the right one?
Indeed. The more assumptions you have to make, the more unlikely an explanation is. The easiest explanation, in this scenario, is that an alligator consumed Judd's remains and then transmitted the infection to the hapless Mr. Horton. The alligator itself could have turned zombie, or a variation thereof.
That's possible?
With a normal parasite, no. But there's nothing normal about this shambler infection. I shudder to think of this dreadful mutation passing to animals. Until contrary evidence surfaces, I will hold on to the hope the alligator was simply an unafflicted means of transmission. A vector, like mosquitoes and malaria.
Precisely. Search parties are still looking for the other hunter, I said. And those alligators are out there.
I shifted, worry rising. What if a whole bunch of gators chowed down on Judd?
What if there's an army of zombie-making gators out there? We need to find them.
That is being discussed, he said, exuding calm. But there are quite a few alligators in those swamps. Pierce believes it would be a futile search, unless we have a way to identify them.
What does Marcus think? Marcus was the publicly recognized head of the tribe, though Pierce Pietro still secretly held the real power. However, Pierce couldn't openly contest Marcus without blowing his cover. If Saberton ever found out that certain zombies had unique and heightened abilities, such as changing physical form, they wouldn't stop until every mature zombie had been hunted down and locked in a lab for heinous experimentation.
Marcus agrees with Pierce, Dr. Nikus said, though he is more open to the idea of at least making an on-site assessment in the swamp.
I can work with that, I said sweetly, triggering a quiet snort from Dr. Nikus. Alligators don't usually go looking for trouble and tend to avoid people tromping through their territory. We'd be searching for aggressive gators, and the other hunter, too. I don't know what condition he's in, but if he's a shambler, we don't want him attacking whoever finds him.
Agreed, but the...
I sucked in a breath. I think I know how to find the hunter. And maybe the gators as well. I scratched Marla's ears. She knows what zombies smell like.
Dr. Nikus winced. Yes, she does, but she's been living with us for nearly a month and has most likely gone nose blind.
Oh. I slumped and considered for a moment. But Judd and Douglas were mutant zombies, and Douglas's brain smelled funny when I sniffed it at the morgue. What if it's distinctive enough for Marla to zero in on it?
Dr. Nikus pursed his lips and thought, interesting.
We have the samples and could test the theory with Dante Rosario's help.
He met my eyes and gave me a conspiratorial wink. And if your theory pans out, we'll take your idea to Marcus.
I'd met Dante Rosario a week or so before Mardi Gras, when he was involved in a number of anti-zombie plots dreamed up by Dr. Christy Charish. After a variety of hijinks and disasters, I managed to stop him from revealing zombies as monsters to the world, but during the resulting four-wheeler chase through the woods, he'd crashed and been critically injured. He'd also crashed emotionally when he finally realized Christy had ruthlessly dumped him, thrown him under the bus, and laid the blame for everything on his shoulders. After quite a bit of discussion, and with my very insistent input, the tribe inner circle had agreed that Rosario could be a valuable ally and asset and gave him protection. Even better, Rosario was Marla's handler, which meant we got a sweet package deal. Dr. Nikas and I soon found him doing careful stretching and calisthenics in the weight room. Rosario had been in peak physical condition before his injury, and with the help of surgery to stabilize the mess of his ribs followed by kick-ass physical therapy, he was almost fully recovered. Unfortunately, determining whether Marla could indicate on the shambler samples was a shitload tougher than I expected. First, we had to get past Rosario's, "Are you crazy? You expect me to train her on a new scent in just a few minutes?" Once we convinced him to at least try, it ended up taking nearly 3 hours for Marla to recognize the shambler tissue's distinct scent, and another 3 for her to consistently indicate on it. Even then, we had to put up with Rosario's dire warnings as to how it couldn't possibly be reliable with so little training, and that this sort of thing usually took weeks. It wasn't until Dr. Nikas told Rosario his position with the tribe was safe even if Marla failed to find the shambler scent that I realized the source of his anxiety. If the tribe cut ties with Rosario, Saberton would take him out in a permanent fashion at the first opportunity. Convincing Marcus to organize a gator hunt was a far easier hurdle. He agreed with Dr. Nikas that, for the safety of the tribe and the public, a search should be mounted for the other hunter and any infected alligators. He then surprised me with praise for the insight into gator behavior and the idea to use Marla.
"I hated the thought of doing nothing," Marcus said. "But Pierce..."
He stopped and smiled tightly.
"Using Marla gives us an edge, however slight. Chances are low we'll find anything, but chances are zero if we don't make an attempt."
He glanced at the clock and frowned in thought.
"Early in the morning will be best. That'll give us time to make arrangements. Plus, we need to return no later than noon to allow Angel to get to work at the morgue."
I blinked. "You know my work schedule?"
"And your school schedule."
As I fumbled for a reply, he chuckled.
"I'm not psychic, Angel. You gave all of that info to Dr. Nikas to schedule your shifts here, and I just happened to see it this afternoon when I was going over payroll and scheduling."
"Stalker," I teased, but I was impressed. "You said we. Are you coming too?"
"That's right,"
Marcus said with a determined set to his jaw.
"I'm ready to get out into the field and do something real."
The frustration in his voice tugged at my heart. He wasn't really the head of the tribe, and he knew it. Pierce still called the major shots. Even worse, Marcus had given up law school to be the tribe figurehead. It was doubly galling that he was more than competent enough to run the tribe if Pierce would ever give him the chance. "What if Pierce doesn't agree to this?" I asked reluctantly. Dr. Nikas spoke up.
"I will make certain he does."
A whisper of relief passed over Marcus's face.
"I appreciate the help."
I cleared my throat. "How early will we be leaving?"
"Sunrise is around 7, he said. "But it starts getting light before 6, and since alligators are nocturnal, I'd like to be on the water and searching well before dawn. With travel and prep time, I'd say plan on a 4:30 departure.
"Uh-huh. Just to be sure we're on the same page here, you want us to leave at 4:30 in the morning, which, by the way, is technically still night.
Correct.
Ugh. It was a 30-minute drive from my house to the tribe lab, which meant I'd have to leave home by 4 a.m., which meant I'd have to wake up around 3:30. Yeah, I think I'll just crash here tonight if that's okay. Besides, I already had extra clothes stashed at the lab. I'd learned the hard way to keep a few changes here, including a spare coroner's office uniform, since shit could go sideways at any moment. And a change of underwear, or more, might be needed. Dr. Nikus's eyes crinkled in a smile. A wise decision. He shifted his attention to Marcus. Shall we go beard the lion in his den? Marcus blew out his breath.
Sure. This will be fun.
But then he shot a grin my way before the two headed off to double-team Pierce. Once they were gone, I texted my dad to tell him not to wait up for me. Even though staying the night at the lab made the most sense, I felt bad about being away from home again so soon. Yet to my relief, he replied that he'd scored another job doing cleanup at one of the local bars and didn't figure he'd be home till darn near 4 in the morning himself. For once, the universe seemed to be cutting me some slack. Maybe in return I should be responsible and study biology? After all, I had a test on the digestive system next week. On the other hand, if I went to bed in the next 10 minutes, I could score 6.5 hours of sleep. The buzz of a text message saved me from grappling with the decision. I smiled as I saw it was from Justine Chu, who'd starred in High School Zombie Apocalypse. I'd met her during the zombie fest when I rescued her from a fan who was being way too handsy, and we'd quickly struck up a friendship. Well, how was your first day back? Can you video chat? Give me 5 minutes. I texted, then dashed to my room. Chapter 7. My room was the same one I'd occupied for the past 2 weeks, after coming out of the regrowth tank. Though similar in size and layout to Kang's, it was far homier, especially since it lacked both steel door and surveillance. The bed had been made up with fresh sheets since I'd left this morning, and my clothes were still in the dresser. Best of all, the laptop I'd been using for the past few weeks was on the table where I'd left it. I shucked off my shoes, made myself comfy on the bed with the laptop, and fired up the video chat program. I had told Justine the same fiction as everyone else who didn't need to know the truth, that I'd come down with mononucleosis right after Mardi Gras. Since then, we'd texted or video chatted darn near every day. After a moment, the video chat icon blinked. Justine's face popped up on the screen. Asian American with pretty delicate features and dark eyes that practically snapped with determination. Hey, you survived your first day back at work. Go you. Go me. She peered at my face. You don't look tired, which is good. You don't want to overdo it. I promise I'm not. I made a show of crossing my heart. She nodded sharply in approval. Did you get anything good and gruesome today? Kind of. A hunter drowned and got chewed up by an alligator. That much was true. No way could I tell her the rest. Ew. At least he hadn't been in the water long, I said. I remember one time we picked up a body that had been in the bayou for over a week. His skin kept slipping off as we pulled him in. Justine listened in morbid fascination as I related the disgusting details. I'd come to enjoy her friendship way more than expected. Maybe because I'd never really had a female best friend before? I mean, I was friends with Naomi, and I could totally hang out with her, but somehow it wasn't on the same level. Justine was fun, yet able to be serious and understanding. Plus, she gave every indication of enjoying my friendship just as much. I had a feeling part of it was because I didn't suck up to her, even though she was kind of famous. She could be straight up honest with me and vent about Hollywood and the jerks she had to deal with. And while Justine didn't know I was a zombie, I could still share my triumphs and woes on a purely human level. How did your audition go? I asked once I finished describing bloated corpses. Oh, they totally hated me, and I'll never work as an actor again. She cracked up at my stricken expression. I'm kidding. That's what I always say. It feels like a jinx to say I thought it went well. You are so weird. Ha! I'm not the one who works with dead bodies, she cocked her head. So, are you going to be a pathologist? Me? I scoffed. No way. I can barely handle my two measly community college classes, and I'm probably going to drop English anyway. What? Why? I shifted, grimaced. I had shared a lot with Justine, but had skimmed over a few things. She knew I was an addict, but didn't know my mom went to jail for child abuse. She knew I'd dropped out of high school, but didn't know I had a learning disability. I had kept stuff to myself because a stupid little seed of uncertainty refused to leave. Justine was cool and hot and smart. What if she decided I wasn't worth the trouble? That's stupid, I told myself, and stomped that little seed to dust. Okay, well, you see, I'm dyslexic, so it takes me forever to read the assignments, and I stopped and gulped as her eyes went wide. What's wrong? This is crazy, she breathed. I just registered for the fall semester at UCLA to finish my degree. She leaned close to the camera. In English education. Wait, you're going to college? But you're an actor. You starred in a movie. The acting is how I'm paying for college, Justine said. Don't get me wrong. I absolutely adore acting, but I can't count on it lasting forever as a career. You never know what life will throw at you, so I want to get my degree under my belt. She drew a deep breath. Look, the only experience I have with dyslexia is a special needs course I took 2 years ago, but I could probably help with everything else. Give you a little leg up at least? I mean, if you want. I don't want to pressure you. Her mouth quirked. Too much. That would be great, I said, then winced. But it's not just the dyslexia stuff. I'm supposed to write a narrative essay about a birthday party I had when I was a kid, but I've never had a birthday party. My mom... Well, let's just say my childhood sucked. I don't know. I guess I could make something up. Her dark eyebrows pulled together in a frown. Why would you make something up? I don't think the prof really wants to read about the time my mom busted my lip and burned all my toys in the backyard because I was singing Happy Birthday too loud. Instead of looking shocked or pitying, Justine gave her head a firm shake. Your prof wants you to write about what happened to you. If you make it up, he'll know it's bullshit because there won't be any real emotion in it. Besides, he knows damn well he's going to get a bunch of essays about bad shit. The only birthdays anyone remembers are the ones where stuff went wrong. I let out a sigh. Yeah, it's always easier to remember the bad shit. That's how our brains are wired. Damn stupid design, but I guess it was good for survival at one point. She lifted her chin. Anyway, I've written a god-awful number of essays in my life. I know all the tricks. I'll help you. Thanks, I said fervently. And even if she couldn't help me, I still had a couple of weeks to drop the class. The conversation shifted to lighter subjects like celebrity butts and boob jobs. Yet, after we finally disconnected, my thoughts returned to her question about being a pathologist. Jeez. After chatting damn near every day for the past 2.5 weeks, I'd have thought she knew me better than that. I closed the laptop and checked the time. I'd lost out on 30 minutes of sleep, but it had been totally worth it. After finding my toothbrush and degunking my teeth, I changed into a nightshirt, set my alarm for 4 a.m., and snuggled between sheets that smelled of lavender. I startled awake to a hard rap on the door. What? You are needed in the conference room. That was Brian Archer, longtime head of tribe security and now second to Pierce. We're planning this alligator expedition. I fumbled for my phone. Wow, I'd managed to sleep for a whole 20 minutes. Okay, be there in 5.
Make it 3, Brian said, then his footsteps retreated down the corridor. I shot the door my middle finger, then scrambled out of bed.
I changed back into my work clothes, then speed-walked to the conference room only to find it empty. Weird. I was sure Brian had said conference room. Maybe I'd misheard him and I was supposed to go to the media room? I turned to leave and ran right into the broad chest of the man himself.
I didn't expect you to be so fast, Brian said as he steadied me. I was joking about the 3 minutes.
Jerk. I aimed a light punch at his abs. He blocked it with a swift move.
You'll have to do better than that.
You definitely deserve worse. I could have slept another 5 minutes. Naomi pushed past us into the room.
Save your punches for Kyle. He deserves them.
What happened? I asked, registering her bedraggled appearance and red eyes and nose.
Oh no, have you been crying?
My fists clenched. What did Kyle do?
No, I haven't been crying, she snarled. And by the way, you should never ask someone if they've been crying, because if they have been crying, which I wasn't, it'll only embarrass them and make them cry more.
She paused, held up a finger, then turned her head to deliver a mighty sneeze into her elbow. Now the red eyes made sense.
So noted.
But my question stands, what did Kyle do to deserve punches?
He forgot that some of us have human immune systems.
Naomi pulled a tissue from a pocket and wiped her nose.
All I can say is, we were working an op that required us to hide for nearly an hour in a water-filled ditch. Cold water.
I gave her a wince of sympathy.
Yeah, I gotta say, I don't miss getting colds.
Well, I haven't gotten this one yet, she declared, then spoiled it by blowing her nose.
I'll be fine by morning. Lots of vitamin C and fluids. Works every time.
Before I could question her confidence, Pierce strode in, with Marcus a second behind him carrying a tube of rolled paper. Pierce took up a position where he could see everyone, playing the part of the security chief and definitely not the actual tribe leader, no siree. Marcus went to the table and unrolled a detailed map of Mudsucker Swamp and the surrounding area. He glanced up as Rosario entered.
Close the door, will you, Dante? We're all here now.
He waited for the latch to click, then addressed the room.
Everyone here has been briefed on the situation with the drowned hunter who reanimated in Angel's morgue. At her suggestion, tomorrow morning, we're going to the swamp with 3 goals. To search for the other accident victim, to locate any possibly infected alligators, and to avoid drawing attention.
He lifted his chin toward Rosario.
Marla will hopefully give us an edge in finding the body. I've figured out some details that should help as well.
He gestured for everyone to gather around the table, then angled the map so we could see it.
That's Bayou Pouvre on the right side of the map. The blue dot marks the inlet where the overturned boat was found wedged between a couple of cypress trees.
He traced his finger up along the bayou until it reached a red dot several inches away.
Here's where Mr. Horton's body was found. Search and rescue is operating under the assumption the boat hit a submerged log and overturned in this immediate area, then drifted nearly a mile with the current before getting stuck in this inlet.
He dragged his finger back downstream to the blue dot.
It makes a degree of sense because when someone drowns, they tend to sink right where it happened. Plus, the direction of the current supports it. But at the estimated time of the accident, the tide was coming in, which would all but cancel out the current. Moreover, winds were from the south last night, so I don't believe it's possible for the boat to drift so far.
Naomi turned away to sneeze, then peered at the map.
If all that's true, where do we find the second body? We're going to search the area where the boat was found.
Marcus tapped the blue dot.
The real accident site.
With the tide, the wind direction, and how this waterway curves, the only way for the boat to get stuck in the inlet is if the accident happened very close by. The boat didn't move. The victim did.
Because the gator dragged Douglas Horton to where he was found, I said.
And search and rescue would never consider that a possibility.
Especially because that's not normal behavior for an alligator, Marcus agreed. But, of course, we're not dealing with normal alligators.
Brian rubbed his jaw.
We already know from the bite marks there was more than one alligator. How do we know the second body didn't get dragged off, too?
Marcus spread his hands.
We don't. But the accident site is the most logical place to start. I expect when search and rescue continues to come up dry, they'll look at the issue with the wind and tides and realize their error. However, my intel says that hasn't been discussed yet. We should have a good chunk of the morning to search without interference. That said, I want to be there on the scene and ready to search the instant there's enough light.
I'm making arrangements for boats and gear, Pierce said. We'll put in at the tribe training ground. It's west of Mudsucker and quite a bit farther from the accident site than the public boat launch. But it avoids unwanted attention. Not to mention, Angel can show us where she killed Judd Siller.
I'll try, I said with a heaping load of uncertainty. He smiled winningly.
I have all the faith in the world in you.
This is no time for jokes, Pierce.
Naomi sniffled again.
Do we have a cover story, or are we just going to meander around the swamp and pretend to also be looking for a dead guy? Pierce shook his head.
That could draw attention we don't want. Easiest cover story is we're hunters.
I frowned. Turkey is the only thing in season right now.
Then we'll be turkey hunting,
he replied with a glare. Marcus grimaced.
But no one in their right mind would hunt turkeys from a boat.
Pierce glowered as I nodded in agreement.
Well, if that's the only thing in season now, we don't seem to have much of a choice.
No, it's all good, I said. You see, nuisance animals are legal to hunt year-round, and because of the floods last year, feral hogs are a huge problem. Coyotes, too. It's totally plausible to be hunting those in the swamp from a boat. Pierce's glower vanished.
Okay.
Good.
That works.
He paused.
Thanks.
I inclined my head in acknowledgement. Marcus made notes on a pad.
Everyone needs current hunting licenses in case we get stopped by wildlife and fisheries. We can buy them online and print out the e-licenses.
I have a lifetime license, I said, hiding a smile at Marcus's look of surprise. Back when Randy and I were dating, his dad had taken us deer hunting. I was 18 and had never gone hunting for a darn thing in my life, but obediently froze my ass off in a deer stand and then insisted to Mr. Winger I'd had fun because it was clear he really wanted me to enjoy it. Not long after that, he went ahead and spent the several hundred bucks on a lifetime permit for me because he knew me and my dad couldn't afford even the basic annual license. I went out several times more with him and Randy, and though I never developed a love for hunting, I found a respect for it. I even made sure to get a replacement license after I lost the original in the flood. Seemed wrong not to.
I have one too, Naomi said, then grinned. Never know when a hunting license will come in handy during an op.
Marcus laughed under his breath.
Well, the rest of us will have to settle for cheap and basic.
He jotted down the names of everyone who needed a license.
All right, that should do it. We'll meet in the garage tomorrow at 04:30, and yes, Angel, that's still in the morning.
Damn. Chapter 8. My alarm went off at 4 a.m., and when I finished cursing, I flipped on the lights. That sparked another round of cursing, but it kept me from falling asleep again.
When my eyes finally adjusted, I found a pair of boots and a pile of neatly folded clothing on the chair by the bed. Kind of freaky to realize someone had crept into my room while I was sleeping, but hey, new threads. 10 minutes later, I was clothed and booted in the camo hunting gear. Extra, extra small that actually fit me. With teeth clean, bladder emptied, and hair shoved into a mostly neat ponytail, I took a detour to the kitchen for a ham and egg sandwich and still made it to the garage by 4:15. The enormous garage. Large enough to hold a dozen vehicles with room to spare and secured by a double set of heavy security doors. Halfway across the garage, Marcus and Pierce conferred near the back of a dark blue Chevy Tahoe. Not far away were Brian, Rosario, and Marla. I hustled over to them. At least Naomi wasn't here yet, which meant I wasn't last. Rosario crouched to adjust Marla's harness, black tactical pants stretching tight over his scrumptious ass. Yep, that right there was why I'd dubbed him Tactical Pants Man before I even knew his name. Sexist as hell, but damn. It was truly a work of art. The door from the lab opened behind me, and I spun, ready to gloat at Naomi for beating her here, but my salty comment died away at the sight of the tall black woman striding in. Rachel Delancey, wearing camo pants and a black t-shirt. A jacket was draped over one arm, and her long braids had been pulled back into a tight knot. Ugh, if Rachel was here, it meant Naomi was too sick to come, which sucked. Naomi was fun and cool. Rachel hated my guts. And now it looked like I was going to be stuck in a boat with her for hours. I summoned a bright smile. Hi, Rachel. Is Naomi coming too? If the universe really loved me, Naomi would be totally recovered